Support comes from the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center, James Cancer Hospital, and Solove Research Institute. Just as no two people are exactly the same, neither are their cancers. At the OSU CCC James, there is no routine cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. 1 in 12 children in the U.S. will lose a parent or sibling before turning 18. That number is closer to 1 in 10 for Ohio children. That's according to the JAG Institute, a research center focused on education and training on the issue of childhood bereavement as a public health issue. The pandemic has played a role in the increase of grieving children, to be sure, but there's no reason to believe that the rate will decrease anytime soon either. Mickey Burns is a licensed psychologist for the JAG Institute. Mickey Burns, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, Ann. Thank you so much for having me to talk about this important issue.
Why is childhood bereavement a public priority?
It's a great question. For a long time, childhood bereavement was really considered something that was a bit of a niche issue. We thought that children didn't grieve or they were resilient and they get over it. What we know from research really over the last 30 years is that if we don't address childhood bereavement, it can contribute to some really significant negative long-term health outcomes. So children who are bereaved due to the death of a parent or a sibling in childhood are more likely to struggle in school. They're more likely to have difficulties in their relationships. They're more likely to face mental health concerns. And there's actually some research that shows there's a higher likelihood that they'll experience earlier mortality themselves. So it really is a critical public issue and really a public health issue.
Do we know why it is that they're more likely to suffer, to struggle in life, have difficulty with relationships? What does not addressing grief in a child have to do with how they grow up?
Well, if you think about bereavement specifically, that is when we are losing contact with a significant attachment figure. And so that is a significant loss. And learning how to cope with and manage that sort of setback or disappointment or really just significant life event can set us up for being able to manage other adversities that we face in the future. And there's also research that shows when they ask adults, what was the most traumatic life event that you experienced? Those who experienced a death loss in childhood rate it as the number one most traumatic life experience that they had. So if we're able to wrap around children and families at that time and provide them appropriate care and support, we can really set them on a different trajectory towards more positive health outcomes.
Does it matter why the loss of life, or is it just the absence of that person in their life?
That's a question that I think we're still trying to answer in the research. I can tell you anecdotally that here at JAG Institute and Judy's House, which is our direct service, I, because I'm a psychologist, get to work with children and families who have experienced losses. And what we see is that when those losses are associated with any sort of trauma, so for example, a suicide death loss, or a sudden overdose death loss, or even a long-term illness, such as cancer, where you watch your important person, your loved one, go from somebody who's strong and healthy and resilient to sometimes not being able to even lift a spoon to their mouth. That in and of itself can be traumatic for children. And so when these loss experiences are associated with trauma, that's really where we see the more complexity and difficulties coming into play.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about child bereavement. My guest is Mickey Burns. She's a licensed psychologist and the chief clinical officer for the JAG Institute. That's a Denver-based research center focused on childhood bereavement. We're seeing lots of events now, and between just regular news channels and social media, mass shootings are very common occurrences. Children are exposed to them information-wise as well. And, you know, I remember after 9/11, people talked a lot about how much should we tell children about this. You know, they're kind of seeing it. Some people were turning off the channel. Well, that was easier in 2001 than it is in 2023, right? So what do we know about how much exposure children should get to these larger societal, you know, tragedies?
Yeah, it's kind of poignant that you and I are meeting today, and it's the 1 year anniversary of the Uvalde shooting.
Yeah.
And I know it's a very somber day for many. I think it is important that we are able to have developmentally appropriate conversations with children about the world events that are happening. When you think about a child going to school, whereas in my day and age, we did tornado drills. I'm from the Midwest as well. Now children are doing lockdown drills. And if we aren't having conversations with them about the impetus for that and why that is happening, it's just going to lead to more confusion. Similarly, when we talk with children about death and about people who died and why they died, we strongly encourage honest conversations that meet children on their level, that can have a level of understanding that is appropriate for them. So when we look at these mass shootings, when we look at the community violence that is unfortunately so prevalent in our country, we strongly encourage caregivers, adults, parents to be having conversations with children and really eliciting their questions and addressing those questions, because you'd rather them hear it from you than hear it from another kid in the classroom.
I'm glad you brought up Uvalde, because I was interviewing a journalist a couple months ago who's been sort of embedded there, and said that the grief counseling those kids were getting was little to no. It was something like 30, maybe 10 or 15 minutes every 2 weeks. What do we mean by this grief counseling when we hear counselors will be on hand to you know, address any concerns students might have? What does that mean? And are you confident that it's really adequate?
Yeah, I can't speak specifically to the response in Uvalde. I do know that there's a center out of San Antonio who's been trying to provide some support to the community. And I think a big part of what we know from the work that we do as your friend is embedded in that community is if we are not embedded in a part of that community, it's hard to trust that that support is really going to be there. It's hard to open up and be vulnerable when it seems as if that support is fleeting or temporary. So I think that it's important that we're assessing children individually. At Judy's House and JAG Institute, we do individual assessments with each member of the family who seeks our services, in order to really understand, what does this child need? Not every child is going to need support. Not every child is going to need counseling. A lot of them are going to get what they need from their family, from their faith community, from their schools. But for about 18 to 20%, a more intensive intervention may be warranted. So we need to be able to get in there and ask the questions and really hear from these children. What are you struggling with? What does that look like? What are the thoughts that you're having, the feelings, the body reactions, and what kind of therapeutic intervention or community intervention do you need?
You know, interviewing children, I can tell you from my point of view, is a struggle. It's not something most of us look forward to in journalism, because the way they express and what brings them out is different, and sometimes doesn't fit into a nice package for us. So I'm wondering about, you know, how grief is experienced differently by children, and how, as a child counselor, you manage grief, you know, manage that conversation differently than others, or not at all?
Yes, it's important that we have highly trained professionals or community members who are able to intervene with children. So being able to go into schools and talk with teachers about, how do you bring up death and bereavement and loss in your classroom, and how do you facilitate those conversations? I can tell you that when we sit down to talk with a child about the death of their sibling or the death of their parent or grandparent, we are using a lot of play intervention. Play is the language of children, not the kind of dialogue you and I are having yet. And so we want to make sure that we have lots of different environments for them to move through. Here at Judy's House, we have a space that looks like a doctor's office. We have a space that looks like a home. We have a space where kids can dress up and be anything they need to be. And through that, through sand tray therapy, art therapy, they're really able to express to us how this loss is impacting them. And we know that children grieve in little bits. So it might show up as a temper tantrum at the grocery store when you said we're not having ice cream for dinner. And then they're just fine for a little bit. Whereas as adults, it tends to be something that's present with us ongoing, especially for those who have had a recent loss. It's hard to take ourselves out of that. But kids come in and out of it. I really share with the caregivers who come to Judy's house and JAG Institute that we could learn a lot from watching the way that children grieve. They express their grief when they feel it, and then they don't feel guilty when they don't, which is something that we really struggle with.
But talk about older kids, adolescents, teenagers, how things get complicated then in that way?
Yeah, we work with a wide range of ages here. And what we see is as we start to move into those tween years, those middle school years, children really stop looking outwardly to adults for support and really start turning to their peer community. It's another reason why we highly encourage schools and other environments where children gather to do system-wide bereavement education. So talking with kids who aren't grieving about how to be a supportive friend, because in those instances, it's really hard when you're a 13-year-old who's lost your dad to go to school and not just want to fit in. And so in that desire to fit in, you may avoid or push down those grief reactions that you're having so that you don't seem different. And what we know is that there isn't a space for you to feel those feelings, to express those thoughts, to have those reactions, it can really start to accumulate and weigh you down. And so it's also important, just like having those specially trained professionals and community members who can work with those young children, that we likewise have individuals who are really specially trained with eliciting a response from middle schoolers and high schoolers and other teenagers and young adults. It's a really critical time where we can help them to develop skills that are going to help them for the long haul.
You know, I kind of grew up during the Vietnam War, and we knew people were dying over there. We'd see it on TV, and we all watched it together, for one thing. And my parents really, I don't remember them ever saying, leave the room. It wasn't none of that. But I kind of wonder, that's one thing. So I know that these people, another part of the world, they're in this war, and people are dying, and I understood that. But I don't know how a child cognitively manages the death of another child who there was their classmate, it maybe one, if not dozens in some cases. How does that change the equation for you as a counselor?
I think it goes back to that individualized, tailored response. So how one child responds to the death of a classmate may be very different to how another child responds. Their own history of grief and loss is going to come into that. And so making sure that we are coming in with a response for the entire classroom, but where we can identify children who may need something more than, you know, just that 1 hour time with a grief counselor in a group, and being able to talk with them one-on-one about their experience and how that differs from their peers.
Do you think when they're doing those drills, I can't remember what you called them, but the drills they do to protect themselves if there's a shooter, do they package those drills with some kind of group talk, you know, group
That's
counseling?
That's a great question. Yeah, I to be honest, I don't know, but you may have just struck upon something that we really need to be doing in our classrooms. We talk a lot about trauma-informed education.
Yeah.
And I would assume that with many of our schools moving towards trauma-informed classrooms, that would be something that they are integrating into those drills.
Mickey Burns, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mickey Burns is a licensed psychologist and chief clinical officer for the JAG Institute. That's a Denver-based research center focused on childhood bereavement. We're talking about that because 1 in 12 children in the U.S. will lose a parent or a sibling before turning 18, and that number is closer to 1 in 10 for children in Ohio. Something to think about. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth, and the last person to see them live was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to The Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Retirement is an exciting and often highly anticipated life event, but retirement for some also means the loss of identity, community, and routine of a long career. And that can lead to poor mental health, with one study finding that nearly one in three retirees suffer from depression. Dr. Ashley Subler is a geriatric psychiatrist at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. She focuses on the prevention, evaluation, diagnosis, and treatment of mental and emotional disorders in older adults, including many patients before and during their retirement. Dr. Subler, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So how do you suss out retirement-related depression from just age-related depression or other issues?
Well, depression is a medical condition, so it's not, you know, a deficiency of character or a battle of wills. It is something that is oftentimes, in order to treat it effectively, you need professional help from either a therapist or a mental health professional like myself, during the retirement period, it's a vulnerable period of time when individuals who are susceptible to developing depression develop a major depressive episode or clinically significant depressive symptoms during that period of time. And a pre-retirement history of depression certainly puts you at higher risk of developing depression. Okay. During retirement. So there is a genetic, biologic component to it as well. We're not all going to retire and struggle, but certain people can.
So if you're already treating it and recognizing it and taking care of it before retirement, does that give you better odds of not having it become an issue in retirement?
Oh, certainly. If you're already tied to care, if you already know what to look out for, people who are engaged in treatment and have obtained remission from their depression, who continue to engage with care and treatment, have a better likelihood of staying in remission when they encounter stressful life events, whether it's retirement or something else.
You know, one symptom is increased fatigue. And I really thought about that because a good friend retired a few years ago from a really high pressure job as a president of a big company. And apparently his wife told me he like slept every day. He'd sleep for about an hour and a half in the morning and then he'd sleep for a couple hours in the afternoon every day. But after about 7 or 8 months, he just snapped out of it. It wasn't really depression. He was actually tired. So how do you, I think he was just mentally tired, but you know, why, what is the energy component here and what should people look for?
That's complicated, and especially in older adults, depression is oftentimes under-recognized and therefore under-treated because it can look so different than the classic depression that you would expect in younger counterparts. And low energy can certainly be a part of it. Disruption to sleep schedule can certainly be a part of it. Though in isolation, any number of these symptoms can also be a component of other medical problems as well. So you have to look at the symptom in context. And it's not always clear, even to me, and I do this on a daily basis, whether or not something is depression, because it looks so different depending upon who you're caring for. And that gets really tricky. So I don't have a great answer for you, mm-hmm. but you know, low energy, sleep, insomnia is a big complaint. Social withdrawal, irritability are the big ones I see, especially in older gentlemen. And we call it in my line of work a non-dysphoric depression or depression without sadness, because they will typically come to my office because their spouse has noticed a change in their behavior, because the adult children have noticed a change in their behavior. And the person themselves does not endorse those typical psychological symptoms of depression, like sadness or depressed mood. And they themselves may not recognize that what they're struggling with is one impairing their quality of life, their function, and maybe a component of a mood disorder that needs professional help.
You know, there. I'm wondering if there's a way to prepare. It's a little too late for me, but if there's a way to prepare for retirement to beforehand to address it.
I would encourage people to think about what they're going to do with their time. From the moment we start our jobs, we start to prepare financially for retirement. There's a lot of discussion about saving up. How much money am I going to need? What kind of retirement financial plan am I going to choose when we start new careers or new jobs? And we work towards this goal, but no one really talks about, at least from my experience, what happens afterwards. Because you're talking about 40 plus hours a week for most of us. That's very structured. For many of us, it's a sense of identity. We align professionally and personally with our professions, our jobs. And it provides a lot of structure. And all of this goes away. And so there's just this giant hole on a daily basis that could potentially last decades, depending upon when you retire. And what are you going to do with that space and that time? You know, how are you going to maintain routine? And it can be as simple as going to bed at the same time every day, waking up at the same time every day, you know, exercising on a regular schedule, keeping track of how much you're drinking, because the unhealthy habits that tend to creep into our daily lives when we don't have that structure, that job to wake up for every single day. Alcohol use escalates, other things kind of fall apart. Relationships aren't maintained quite as well as they used to be. So being mindful of those things and having a plan in place to really help maintain the healthy, normal habits and routines of daily life.
I asked a woman who was retiring some years ago, what was she most looking forward to? And she said, laying in bed in the morning and listening to the rain and knowing I don't have to get up. And I thought that was a really beautiful thing, kind of being present in the moment. What about meditation and those kinds of ways of, you know, being out in nature, all of that, that you now have time to do?
Yeah, I am a huge advocate for mindfulness, which is meditation is a kind of mindfulness. We're just living in the moment, being mindful of what's around you without assumption or judgment, you know, just thinking, feeling, using your five senses to take it all in is a fantastic grounding technique. Having space and the time to do that. We can all do that, regardless of whether you're retired or not. Mm-hmm. I think that's a fantastic skill to learn at any point in life.
And then you mentioned exercise. You reminded me of the book Younger Next Year, where, you know, actually as you age, you really should be get more exercise. What that might look like might change over time. You might not be doing, you know, things that clobber your knees, but, you know, you should be out and about, right?
Yeah, the American Heart Association and the CDC both recommend 150 minutes a week, which translates roughly into 30 minutes of moderate aerobic exercise a day. And you don't have to run a marathon. It can be something like walking for 30 minutes a day. And it actually acts as a natural antidepressant in a lot of ways. Exercise, it has benefits physically, but it also has benefits mentally.
Some people say as they age, well, I don't want to get another dog or cat because I'm getting older. What about pets?
Oh, goodness. I'm a huge dog lover.
I know. So. I know your family.
I've got a fur baby at home. I know, you know, my parents have animals at home. So it's not for everyone, but they can be a source of companionship for those that are up to the task. I don't want to belittle the amount of care that they require. I know cats tend to be easier, but I've never taken care of one. Disclosure. But dogs are a lot of work. So if you are up for it, they can be a great source of accountability because they will get fed on a schedule. They will wake you up in the morning. You do have to take them for walks. But also finding a volunteer opportunity. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Volunteer opportunity or, you know, something else to fill your day with. Whether it's another part-time job, something that you've always wanted to do but haven't had an opportunity to do, though that is certainly not a requirement.
A lot of times people just before retirement, they say, oh, we're going to downsize. We got to get, you know, get rid of the house, change everything, change everything up. And I remember I did that right before I had my child. And I kind of regret it because I was not in a good state of mind to make such a huge change and have a kid. What about that whole life's change? Now, some people have to do it because of finances. Of course, that's a different story. But what about that big change everything all at the same time routine?
Well, I would say everyone's circumstances are a little bit different. So I can't say blanket statement, don't do it. But it's a huge transition period. I mean, it's massive for some people, and also changing the familiar environment, the house, all of those other components at the same time can just be a bit jarring. So if you know that change is difficult for you, perhaps take one thing at a time, that moving or downsizing to a smaller house, if you're financially able to make a kind of stagger those life changes is something that I know I would struggle with personally if I were the one making these decisions for myself. And I can say from my own experience talking to folks who have done everything all at once that it can be a lot.
Do some people not, you mentioned particularly males may not notice that their anger or whatever, they're being irritated a lot. They don't see that as necessarily a sign of depression. But in general, do people not realize that they're experiencing signs of depression? Can they confuse them with what they think are natural results of the body aging and that kind of a thing?
All the time. And it comes down to, you know, what is healthy normal aging, what physiologic changes do we expect? And that's where my background is. So people will come to me because they were referred by their primary care physician, or the patient themselves or a family member found me on the internet and, you know, come in with all of these questions. And that's the number one thing I get. Well, it's just memory problems. You know, it's just this, it's just that. And there's this knee-jerk reaction to just attribute it all to getting older. And there are certain things we do expect. There are certain sleep changes, certain, you know, cognitive changes that we expect, but there are a lot of things that aren't a part of normal, healthy aging. And you should be able to have, you know, enjoy life, have a fulfilling retirement, do all of the things you want to do. And depression is certainly something that's treatable and preventable in a lot of cases.
Does the culture that we're living in, is it conducive to retiring in a healthy way, non-conducive? Does our culture matter?
That's a good question. And I don't have a good answer for you.
I just wonder if other countries, if they're the rates of depression among retirees are different in other countries. I mean, if we know anything about that.
Well, at the beginning, you mentioned something about 1 in 3. The prevalence of this issue varies so drastically.
Yeah.
Between studies, there's a couple of larger studies that were both done recently in the United States. And one said that retirement was protective. And the other one said, oh, no, your risk is upwards of 30%. And I'm like, how can we have these two things that contradict each other? There's a popularly cited study from the UK, I think in 2013, that also puts the risk of depression after retirement somewhere around 40%, which is a very dramatic number. So it more than likely does change depending upon where you are and how much support you have after retirement. I know there are some cultures that have a mentality of we take care of our older adults. The family units are very kind of maintained. You have multiple generation living together. Yeah. I'd be curious to know, and I don't know for certain whether depression and retirement rates change there versus, you know, in the United States, for example. I'd have to look into that, but I'm curious now. I know from a cultural standpoint, just psychiatric care in general, it makes a huge difference. You have culture-bound syndromes, you have different you know, it all depends on context. What I might see as something that needs treatment or is pathologic, for example, might be very normal in a different culture.
One thing I've noticed is that in a different cultures, and, you know, I'm not certainly not an expert on it, but they tend to respect their elders, have a higher regard for elders. Older people have a more elevated position in society by virtue of their age. And that's not necessarily the case. We're sort of still sort of a youth culture in this country. Do you think that if that could change, would it help?
I'm not sure. Probably, though, if I'm guessing, there are certainly some ageist stereotypes that exist out there that I come across with some frequency, and are the way our programs and just the structure and the services that exist currently don't do a great job of caring for individuals who have mobility needs or cognitive issues that start to develop later on in life. And there are a lot of individuals I care for who are living independently, who probably could benefit or need extra assistance, and they can't obtain it because they financially don't qualify, or you know, those services just don't exist wherever they're living, whether it's rural Ohio or elsewhere. Yeah. And it's frustrating for me. It's detrimental to their recovery from their mental health condition and from a physical standpoint, and puts them at risk both physically and mentally. And it's a discouraging situation to end up in time and time again, as a clinician. And our population is aging.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. So I not to all to be all doom and gloom, but I'm a little worried that at some point we're going to reach a crisis point, and something's going to have to change.
Well, are there enough of you out there?
No.
Geriatric psychiatrists.
No, I.
You're
might
kind of
be
a unicorn almost.
I am. I love that. I want to be a unicorn. I wish there were more of me, yeah. Quite honestly. I remember looking this up the other day, and I might be misquoting this number, but I want to say there are about, no, I don't want to, there are very few of us. I think there are less than, I want to say 2,000 of us working.
Wow. In the country.
As geriatric psychiatrists working in the United States at the moment. Yeah. So I don't know what that works out, you know, individual over the age of 65 per practicing geriatric psychiatrist.
But I'm going to guess it's not enough.
It's not enough. No, there's definitely a need. And that goes for mental health care in general. There's a scarcity of mental health care resources in the community just in general. And then when you start looking at the subspecializations,
Does stigma play much of a role anymore, or are we kind of moving out of that stigmatization of mental health issues?
In my experience with older generations, yes, I still run into that on a regular basis. I suspect that will probably change as the younger generations age and I continue to take care of individuals, because, you know, the Gen Zs do a very good job of talking about mental health and destigmatizing and normalizing it in a lot of ways. But there's a reluctance on the part of many of my patients to admit that they're struggling. And there's a lot of pride and self, you know, independence and being self-made. And depression still has that mentality of, well, it's because I'm not strong enough. And that's definitely not the case. A clinical depression is not something that you're going to will yourself out of.
Dr. Ashley Subler, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
It's Dr. Ashley Subler. She's a geriatric psychiatrist at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. We've been talking about aging and depression, and retirement and depression for that matter. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth, and the last person to see them live was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to The Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In 2022, the U.S. faced an unprecedented surge of drug deaths, with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reporting that in a single 12-month period, fatal overdoses claimed 101,623 lives. But researchers and drug policy experts even then said that the tragic toll obscured an important and hopeful fact. Most Americans who experience alcohol and drug addiction survive. And new research suggests that people who struggle with addiction can experience a higher likelihood of recovery when they incorporate exercise. Gretchen Reynolds is a health columnist for The Washington Post who recently wrote about these findings. We'll have a link to that article at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Gretchen Reynolds, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what do we know? What's the physiological explanation for exercise and substance abuse treatment?
Well, there are a number of ways in which exercise almost certainly helps people recover or at least reduce their dependence on substances. And one is that the very simple fact that it makes you feel better. It improves moods, and that's a start. It also can give people what's called self-efficacy, meaning they feel better about their ability to do anything. And that includes reduce their dependency. And it also, and this was particularly interesting in a number of mouse studies, what they found was that exercise can change the reward center in your brain, your dopamine, which is the famous neurotransmitter that's involved in our wanting things, in our looking for things. Well, the dopamine system becomes very disordered in people who have a substance use disorder. They really want that one substance. And it looks like one thing that exercise does very clearly in mouse studies is it changes the dopamine system. It changes the rewards that you want. And when they have mice become addicted to cocaine, for instance, and then they have them start running, they're much less interested in cocaine. They actually want to get on the running wheel, and they will ignore the, or at least reduce their interest in cocaine. And obviously no one has done those experiments with people, but what they have found with people, and one of the studies that I write about in the column that you're linked to, is a study of people who were part of a treatment program. And if the treatment program included exercise, and very simple exercise, like jogging three times a week, going for a walk, weightlifting, it was not complicated. It wasn't a lot, maybe half an hour to an hour, three times a week. They were far more likely to succeed in their treatment programs, meaning they were much more likely to reduce their dependence on these substances. And that was the only difference in the treatment programs. So it does look like potentially exercise can be really helpful for people who want to, who are interested in reducing their dependence.
You know, I years ago interviewed the founder of a nonprofit organization in Salt Lake City. It's called Fit to Recover. And that's what they're devoted to, recovery and doing it through the lens of exercise and physical well-being. So there's a lot of other aspects to it, but it kind of starts with exercise. But more importantly, I think maybe it's the exercise and the community of exercise. I know that, you know, you and I have talked about before, when I go to my boot camp, partly it's just to go and hang out with these ladies I see there, you know, and have our chats.
And
accountability too. Yeah.
Accountability. And it's definitely true that almost all of the studies in people that have looked at exercise and addiction treatment have involved group programs. And there's certainly a social element. There's a helping one another element. There is, as you said, an accountability element. You are expected by the other people in your group to come on that jog with them and to be sober, or at least be able to complete it. And all of those things probably do matter, which means that it's not yet clear at all that if someone sitting at home and listening to this has concerns about their substance use, that just starting an exercise program on your own will be enough or will be effective. The studies that I write about all looked at formal treatment programs, and this was part of them. So I would not want anyone to take the message that if you're worried about your substance use, just start exercising. What it looks like is that it is a really integral part of the overall treatment program, which includes some of the social elements of being part of a group of people who are trying to accomplish the same thing you are.
Are there certain kinds of exercises that tend to be more effective than others or not?
One of the interesting things about the biggest study that I wrote about was that it covered, it looked at a whole range of exercise programs, everything from weight training, which for some people is really effective at making them feel more competent and healthy, but it also included jogging. Different programs did jogging, some did walking, swimming. It really did look like the exercise itself didn't matter. It didn't even matter if it was aerobic or if it was weight training. What did seem to matter was that you got your heart rate up a little bit and that you were part of a group. And afterwards, moods were so much better. Just people really did feel so much better about themselves.
And
one big obstacle to all of this is that people who are in the midst of substance use concerns are not very motivated to exercise. They're often have mental health issues. They're depressed. They're feeling bad about themselves, which is another reason why it can be really important to join a program with exercise as part of it, just to help get you motivated.
I think back when I did that show about Fit to Recover, it was very unusual to have a program that revolved around exercise and physical well-being for recovery. Is it more common now, do you know?
I think it's becoming much more common. That researchers that I talked to for my story all agreed that at this point, there's good scientific backing for this. It's not just anecdotal stories about people, you know, recovering better, that there's good scientific evidence that it does help people reduce their dependence. And with that scientific backing, you are seeing more of the addiction recovery programs incorporating it, but not all of them do. So it may be worth looking around if you're interested in starting to find one that includes exercise.
Do these programs that incorporate it, do they incentivize people to get into it? Is there a way to get them to take that step?
Some of the programs are definitely experimenting with paying people and paying them a decent amount of money to exercise as part of this, because that is motivation and it's financially, it makes sense. If you can help people to recover, that saves society as well as them a lot of money. So there are good financial as well as moral reasons to do that. And I do know of a number of programs that are experimenting with either monetary payments or other kinds of incentives to get people to just start.
You and I have talked about this before, that people who exercise a lot also tend to drink a lot. And I'm not talking about Gatorade. Is there an explanation for that correlation, and how does that fit into this conversation?
Yeah, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that with beer in particular, that there is what scientists call a positive relationship, meaning the more people work out, the more beer and sometimes other alcohol they tend to drink. And there actually is a correlation with really active athletes tend to be often very heavy drinkers. And they do call that the beer paradox. no one is completely sure why. Most of it is probably psychological, and societal, where people go out for a run or bike ride together and then they go out and drink. But some of it is also people seem to have a health halo around exercising that then they think they can have six beers. And it's not just young men. It's across the board of people who exercise. So one of the things I point out in the study or in the story that I wrote is that scientists do say that just because you exercise, that doesn't mean you won't have a substance use issue. So if you are going for runs and then, you know, having four or five beers with your friends, just take a look at what you're doing. Be aware of it.
Be aware. Hey, I wanted to talk quickly about girl push-ups. I didn't do them until later when my aging shoulders started to, you know, squeak. And now I do them, but I've perfected them. I do them absolutely perfectly. But girls and women are often encouraged to use a modified push-up. It's called the girl push-up. It's where you mostly keep your knees on the ground instead of up. And Keene State College did a study on this. What did they say about it, and what did they learn?
This is a little bit of a campaign of mine. The standard in exercise testing, where they see how strong you are, is that men do full push-ups, women do girl push-ups, and have since the 1930s. And there's no physiological reason for that. And what this Keene State study found was that girls of all sizes, fitness, could do full push-ups. And they wanted to see how that compared to doing the girl push-ups. And they could do, some of them could do easily 20 full push-ups. And so the upshot of this study is that the authors, and I agree with them, think that the formal exercise testing standards, which are set by the American College of Sports Medicine, need to start using full push-ups for women. There's no reason for them to be using the girl push-up. And the ACSM, the American College of Sports Medicine, is now looking into using the full push-up. Because again, there's no physical reason women can't do that push-up.
Unless they have a physical reason, like
exactly.
They have bad shoulders.
If you're not healthy, then don't. But that's true for men, too.
Right, exactly. And another thing is, what is a good push-up? You know, you see people doing these, like, quick punchy things, you know, these pumps. They're not really doing a push-up. And that, you know, for those of us who like a real good, solid push-up, it's frustrating to see people counting that.
Yes, and if you go to the column I wrote, I give step-by-step directions from the experts. But the main thing is, lower yourself relatively slowly and get very close to the ground. Your chest and chin should be close, and then push back up. If you can do one, that's plenty. You know, next week do two. Don't worry, but you'll get much more benefit if you can from doing a full push-up, whether you are a woman or a man. And they're not that hard.
No, they're not. I always start out doing a full push-up, but if I have to, I then, you know, go to the knees. But
and that's totally, totally fine. I'm not saying to anyone they shouldn't do the modified push-up. What I think and what the researchers showed is it's not a girl push-up. It's the modified push-up. And that's true for men and women. So let's take that terminology out of all of
this. I absolutely agree. And one other thing, we're just about out of time, but I wondered, are there other exercises that are gendered or have traditionally been gendered in that way?
Not to the same extent. There are some where they have girls do a modified pull-up, but they don't actually call it something else. So it's mainly the push-up where there's a girl type.
Well, Gretchen Reynolds, this is my last time chatting with you before I retire, and I just want to say thank you. You've just been such a great addition to Wellness Wednesday over the years. Thanks for all your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and have a wonderful time in retirement, and stay active.
I will. You know I will. That's Gretchen Reynolds. She's a health columnist for The Washington Post. She's been joining us on Wellness Wednesday for many years now. That's it for now. Thanks for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.